This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Driven to Distraction at Work, How to Focus and Be More Productive. Written by Edward M. Halliwell, M.D. Narrated by Christopher Kipiniak. Introduction. Attention Deficit Trait. The Growing Workplace Problem. You know the problem. Swarms of distractions, constant interruptions, various tones chiming all around, rampant screen sucking, texting under the table during meetings, the overloading of mental circuits, and frequent feelings of frustration at trying to get everything done well and on time. This is the modern context in which most of us work. Whether the workplace itself or the numerous demands on your time drive you to distraction, the end result is the same. You can't focus on anything anymore at work, and it's taking its toll on your performance and your sense of well-being. Capturing a widespread desperation, Anne Crittenden, in her New York Times review of Bridget Schulte's sobering 2014 book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, allowed that Schulte's sensible solutions were good suggestions, but then punctuated her review with grim resignation. But like all self-help advice, they don't measure up against the entrenched forces that are indifferent, if not hostile, to the emotional well-being of a majority of Americans. Schulte is fighting SEAL Team 6 with a pair of fingernail scissors. This book offers a different view. While I fully agree that we are contending with forces never seen before, and that the modern workplace presents distractions like never before, I also know that any person can learn to modulate distraction and overload well enough to take greater control, while becoming happier, healthier, and more productive in the process. To be sure, as Crittenden, Schulte, and numerous other commentators have shown in well-documented detail, the forces that oppose a sane and measured life today advance en masse like invisible pincers, nipping at us wherever we turn. And this isn't going to let up. If anything, the number of distractions will continue to grow, exponentially. This is why all the commonly offered advice, such as manage your time and to-do lists more efficiently, multitask better, be more organized, don't and can't work. They're only band-aids. Instead, you have to retrain your attention. You have to recognize that the underlying issues of mental distraction, all of which are magnified and even harder to control in the workplace, are within your control. Even if you can't control your environment, you can learn how to reach a more productive mental state of focus, relying on planning, preparation, and technique instead of the frantic efforts people typically use to control their time and attention. Before you think it can't be done, look at Tim Armstrong, CEO of AOL, the man responsible for turning that company around. To combat nanothinking disease, he is in the process of testing a policy at AOL he calls 10% think time, which mandates that all executives spend at least 4 hours a week engaged in an obsolescent activity called thinking. Armstrong told me, "It's been a total game changer for me and for AOL. The companies that take this seriously will have a major strategic advantage in the years to come. Our current problem, the ongoing mental traffic jam, if not gridlock, in which it's always rush hour, grew out of our most spectacular successes, the amazing inventions that define our era. We created the labor-saving devices that catalyzed the unplanned explosion within which we live today. But as Armstrong and enlightened managers everywhere are learning, we can learn to manage what we created. When we learn how to take back controls that we've given away, we can get better at managing our attention and not surrendering it to every distraction. This book will show you how to focus and be more productive at work. In part, I'll cover the 6 most common ways in which people surrender their attention at work and provide targeted solutions for dealing with each one. Then, in part 2, I'll provide an overall plan for managing and training your attention over time so that you are more prepared and more mentally fit to deal with whatever distractions come your way. But first, let me tell you why I am in an excellent position to show you how to overcome today's attention deficit problem. Attention deficit trait. I'm a focus doctor, an MD, now 64 years old as I write these words. I've studied attention and productivity for my entire career. Attention deficit trait, or ADT, is a term I coined in 1994 to describe what I observed at that time to be an increasingly common problem in the modern workplace. Because I am a specialist in attention deficit disorder, ADD, many men and women seek consultation with me, wondering whether they have some form of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. They come to see me because they've lost their ability to focus on anything. They're always in a rush, bouncing from task to task like boats against the current, worried that they're falling behind even as they strive to get ahead. Multitasking, hopping from project to project, emailing while talking on the phone, rushing from meeting to meeting, texting under the table, squeezing in one last call while frantically trying to get to the next appointment on time, ending the day with a frustrated feeling of neither fulfilling all of their goals nor performing at their best, let alone with equanimity. These people look as if they have true attention deficit disorder, when in fact, most of the time, they do not. Instead, most of these people have a severe case of modern life, what I came to call attention deficit trait, or ADT. ADT differs from ADD or ADHD in that it is caused by the context in which it occurs, while true ADD or ADHD are genetic in origin. That means ADT comes and goes. You may have it during the week, but not on weekends or on vacation. Or you may have it when you are in a certain work setting or when interacting with some people but not others. Because people develop ADT in an effort to cope with the stresses in their lives, and because the symptoms actually help them in the short term, the symptoms are sticky and may solidify into firm habits even when life slows and becomes less stressful. As I saw more and more cases of ADT, I wrote about the problem in an article in the Harvard Business Review called Overloaded Circuits: Why Smart People Underperform. As I discussed in that article and a subsequent book, Crazy Busy, Overstretched, Overbooked, and About to Snap, ADT originates externally, like a virus. It then penetrates into a person's life via the senses and then the brain. It is brought on by the incessant demands, temptations, and opportunities that hijack our attention, filling our heads with a cacophony of mental noise. As our minds fill with such noise, spasmodic synaptic snaps signifying nothing, the brain loses its ability to attend fully and thoughtfully to anything. The symptoms of ADT gradually take over a person. The sufferer doesn't experience a single crisis. The individual doesn't say, "It started the day my boss went crazy," or "It happened the day of the merger," or even, It started when I got my iPhone. Like dementia, the onset of ADT is far more subtle and insidious. The average worker suffers a series of minor annoyances, finds memory more of a problem than ever, notices the workday becoming ever more unpredictable but definitely longer, and finds it harder and harder to keep up. Not aware how profoundly the circumstances of her life are changing, she does what she always does. She soldiers on. She takes responsibility. She sucks it up and doesn't complain even as her workload morphs into a monster she can't manage. For a grim illustration, imagine the anecdote of the boiled frog. If you take that frog and drop it into boiling water, it will try like mad to jump out. But if you put that same frog into a pot of cold water and gradually turn up the heat, you'll end up with a boiled frog. For most of us, the heat got turned up by the advent of the internet, by the shrinking number of people holding assistant positions, and by the corporate focus on efficiency and productivity, regardless of the human cost. Fate gave me a catbird seat from which to observe the growing epidemic of ADT that we are experiencing today. I've witnessed the vaporization of attention, as if it were boiling away, while people tried valiantly to keep track of more data than even the most adept human brain could possibly accommodate. Since modern life induces ADT, you may wake up in the morning without it, but by 10 a.m. have developed many of the symptoms, which include the following. A heightened distractibility and a persistent feeling of being rushed or in a hurry, even when there's no need to be, combined with a mounting feeling of how superficial your life has become. Lots to do, but no depth of thought or feeling. An inability to sustain lengthy and full attention to a thought, a conversation, an image, a paragraph, a diagram, a sunset, or anything else, even when you try to. A growing tendency toward impatience, boredom, dissatisfaction, restlessness, irritability, frustration, or frenzy, sometimes approaching panic. A tendency to hop from task to task, idea to idea, even place to place. A tendency to make decisions impulsively, rather than reflecting and taking time to think them through. An increasing tendency to avoid thinking altogether, as if it were a luxury you don't have time for. A tendency to put off difficult work or conversations, coupled with a tendency to overfill your day with feckless busy work. A tendency to feel overwhelmed, even when, in reality, you're not. Haunting feelings of guilt about incomplete tasks, coupled with resentment that the tasks were imposed in the first place. Difficulty in fully enjoying pleasant moments and genuine achievements. Too often saying to yourself, I'm working really hard, but I'm not getting to where I want to be, both at work and in relationships. A feeling of loss of control over your own life and a nagging feeling of, what am I missing? A recurring thought that, someday I will make time for what really matters, but I don't have time to do that today. A growing compulsive need for frequent electronic hits, for example, checking emails, speaking on your iPhone, sending or receiving texts, Googling random subjects, visiting favorite websites or playing games, coupled with almost an addict's yen for them when they are unavailable. A tendency to overcommit, make yourself too available, allow too many interruptions, and say yes too quickly. If you see yourself in many or all of these feelings and tendencies, welcome to modern life. ADT is everywhere, especially at work. Consider some of the pernicious effects of ADT. It leads you to respond to others in ways you otherwise wouldn't. How often do you find yourself tuning out when someone, say a colleague or a friend, tells a long, albeit amusing, anecdote, or who poignantly pours his or her heart out while you fake full attention. Sometimes you might hear yourself responding rudely to a person who is trying to explain an important matter to you. How often do you find yourself just saying, "Bottom line it," or "Give me the elevator pitch"? Hyperspeed makes it impossible for you to absorb what's new or different. So instead of finding new material to help you think in unexpected ways, you start thinking in bite-sized, convenient, mundane chunks made up of what's familiar. The stereotypes, slogans, and buzzwords that trigger stock responses and come to define your predictable, prefabricated beliefs, understandings, and convictions. The price of ADT. As we all know only too well, the problem has grown more pervasive and severe, costing organizations hundreds of billions of dollars every year, and individuals their joie de vivre, if not sanity, itself. The biggest price we pay for surrendering our attention is productivity at work. Estimates of the loss of productivity in the workplace, due to screen sucking, time wasted online or in front of a screen, as well as other distractions, vary widely, but all are in big numbers. A study published in Inc. magazine in 2006 estimated that $282 billion was lost annually in the United States to screen sucking. The estimate was based on a study that showed the average worker spent about 2 hours, 1.86 hours to be exact, of every 8 hours at work wasting time, 52% of which was spent surfing the internet. The total bill for the wasted time was $544 billion, 52% of which equals $282 billion. There is actually a nonprofit organization comprising practitioners, researchers, consultants, and other professionals devoted to the problem of information overload. The Information Overload Research Group, IORG, iorgforum.org. According to its website, information overload wastes 25% of information workers' time, costing the U.S. economy alone $997 billion annually. These estimates vary greatly, but there can be no doubt that the real number is huge, and that the waste of time and money is mostly preventable. Another, more subtle serpent, called multitasking, seduces millions of us into sabotaging our productivity. While most of us believe that we can get more done by doing two things at once, the proven fact, as documented as long ago as 1995 by cognitive psychologists Robert Rogers and Stephen Monsell, is that switching attention from one task to the other in rapid succession, which is what multitasking actually is, reduces accuracy, increases errors, and diminishes the quality of the work, whatever it may be. Of course, the cost goes deeper than lost productivity. Imagine ADT in an operating room. Consider this email I recently received from a doctor in charge of training surgeons. I supervise attending urologic and transplant surgeons and am a residency program director and try to articulate and create an environment where good decisions are fostered and made in the course of the surgeon's workday, both in and out of the OR. I found your description of ADT and the brain's survival mode to seem to have application to decision-making in surgery and in daily medical practice. It is my observation that surgeons in the OR typically are handling multiple inputs: pagers, phones, nurses, anesthesia, pressure from delays in a long schedule, etc., and face considerable distraction while they are doing surgery. This, in my opinion, is a setup for acute ADT in the OR. It is particularly a problem when things are not going as planned or expected in the operation, and when the situation demands executive cognitive function, creativity, and mental freshness. It is interesting that with all of the attention directed to making the OR safer, there has been little attention directed to focus on the patient and the operation during the operative event. As Jose Ortega y Gasset wrote in a much different time, "Every destiny is dramatic, tragic in its deepest meaning. Whoever has not felt the danger of our times palpitating under his hand has not really penetrated to the vitals of destiny. He has merely pricked its surface." The surface of our age has grown vaster and more unavoidable than when Ortega wrote in 1930. We all face far greater risk now of only pricking the surface, missing the vitals of life altogether. The modern danger is that we grow so engrossed with and seduced by what matters so little, busy with and ruled by whatever presses upon us, that we overlook and thereby destroy our most important projects and goals through neglect. Prescription for focus. Although I never planned to when I was in medical school or residency, over the past 30-plus years, I've turned focus and attention into my specialty, a specialty that didn't exist when I was in training, but is booming now. If you search for the word focus on Amazon.com, you will get 463,374 titles, including Daniel Goleman's 2013 book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. While this book gives an excellent account of why focus is important to achieving goals, it doesn't look at the many ways people lose their ability to focus at work or provide practical solutions for training the attention and regaining control at work. Most people don't see lack of focus as the root of their problem or even as a possibility. Most of those who consult me simply blame themselves for their failure to be happier or more successful. They don't make excuses or blame the system or a difficult boss. "Maybe I'm just a born underachiever," they conclude. Or, "Maybe I just don't have what it takes to get where I want to get to." They are worried about their jobs, their relationships, and their families. But they only blame themselves in response to the problems they face. People are usually in more pain than they let on. If they even recognize how much their problem relates to impaired focus, they deal with it simply by trying to overpower it. But that's like trying to cure nearsightedness by squinting harder. Ironically, the harder they try, the more likely they are to fail, which leads them to blame themselves even more, thus intensifying the problem. They don't need to work harder, just smarter. This book will teach you to work smarter, not harder. First, by recognizing and dealing with the 6 most common distractions or patterns of ADT at work. And second, by learning a new set of techniques for managing your attention over time, you will be equipped to overcome whatever distraction is holding you back from doing your best work. The 6 most common distractions at work and how to overcome them. Imagine if you could work with the same kind of focus you did 10, 15, or 20 years ago, before the deluge. Imagine if you could repel the tsunami of distractions, interruptions, and sudden changes that buffet you all the time. Imagine if you could control your mind and your work environment so well that you get super focused often and regularly produce work on a par with your best ever. Imagine coming to work eager to get onto a project and confident that you'll get it done well. Imagine living without daily frenzy, frustration, fear, and fizzle. Imagine regaining control over your thinking and emotions, surpassing your best regularly, breaking new ground confidently, and feeling in charge rather than at the mercy of our unpredictable world. That's exactly what I can help you do. In part one, I start with the 6 most common varieties of ADT through which people lose focus at work, including one case of true, full-blown ADHD. I show what each syndrome looks like and give practical tools and advice for addressing each. The people I describe in these chapters are composites of the many I've worked with over my 30 years in practice and share the same kinds of high-pressure lives as most of us. They all obey a brave imperative to keep up with everything at work and at home, to pay the bills, to raise the kids, to do it all, or, as Zorba put it, the full catastrophe. Here are thumbnail sketches of the 6 syndromes I'll cover in sequence, in chapters 1 through 6. Screen sucking. How to control your electronics so they don't control you. Our electronic devices, which help us enormously when used properly, have spawned a new kind of addiction in people who feel a high when hyper-focusing on their electronic screens and feel at a loss without them. In this chapter, you'll meet Les, a financial researcher who has lost his ability to think creatively and connect with others thanks to a screen addiction, driven by deeper feelings of helplessness and loss of control that reach back into his past. Multitasking. How to say no when you have more to do than time to do it. In this chapter, I'll paint a picture of Jean, a lawyer who does everything she can to handle an overwhelming load. Facing a daily onslaught of tasks, people like Jean become increasingly and uncharacteristically hurried, curt, peremptory, and unfocused, while trying valiantly to pretend that everything is under control. Jean's problem was amplified by feelings she developed early in life that she needed always to be good, to do all she was asked to do and more, and to do it all perfectly. No one actually told her she had to be perfect. She put that burden on herself, feeling it was the best way to feel good about herself and about life. Idea hopping. How to finish what you start. The old woman who lived in a shoe, as the nursery rhyme goes, had so many children she didn't know what to do. Like Ashley, whom you will meet in this chapter, some particularly creative, entrepreneurial professionals may have many brain children, but they can't sustain their focus long enough to raise any to maturity. In Ashley's case, the issue ran deeper because her competitive mother ridiculed Ashley's childhood achievements, leaving her with a lifelong feeling that to succeed meant to encounter danger and rejection. Worrying. How to turn toxic worry into problem solving. Many people waste chunks of each day attending to something other than what they want to be attending to, often in response to feelings of anxiety. In this chapter, I'll introduce Jack, a financially successful but incessantly worried executive who carries childhood patterns of fear and anxiety into adulthood in ways that damage his health and prevent him from making the most of his career and having a good relationship with his wife and children. Playing the hero. How to stop fixing everyone's problems except your own. Like many professionals who sabotage themselves by placing the needs of others above their own, Mary also has a knack for carrying the negative water of the organization. The late Professor Peter Frost of the University of British Columbia described such people as heroic toxic handlers who hold the organization together while sacrificing themselves in the process. Mary learned this role early, as a child protecting the rest of the family from a narcissistic tyrant of a father. Dropping the ball. How to stop underachieving at work. Some people suffer from an undiagnosed condition, true ADHD rather than ADT, which causes them to underachieve through an inability to get organized. Like Sharon, their mental focus is clouded by the external chaos and clutter within which they work. The piles, the scattered papers and other materials, the lists, the journals, memos, and other missives, not to mention memorabilia, that accrue every day at home and at work. Sharon's problem was exacerbated by the fact she developed the habit of blaming herself early on in her life, being intensely self-critical and feeling obliged to be good at what she was bad at, rather than pursuing the activities she loved and had talent in. In each chapter, I combine general, practical tips and suggestions with advice rooted in a person's individual psychology. I try to zero in on the emotions involved, not just peruse the details of the chaos. And I try to leave you with tips and takeaways you can use to combat each one of these syndromes. Training your attention. How to manage and maintain your ability to focus. In Part 2, Chapters 7 through 13, I present the elements of a broad, basic plan for managing your attention more generally, with techniques for developing habits to help you consistently find focus and achieve your goals. I provide examples and offer specific tips as the book unfolds. Here are its bones bared. Energy. You, especially your brain, can't focus without energy, and plenty of it. As your supply of energy gets low, you start to fade. Taking steps to monitor your brain's energy supply is as basic and essential as keeping your car's tank full of gas. Most people ignore or take for granted this fundamental necessity, as if the supply was infinite, and they do not monitor carefully how they spend their energy, thus wasting great quantities of it on trivial tasks. But when you invest your energy wisely and see to it that energy tank is always full, you become able to feel positive emotion. Emotion. Emotion is the on-off switch for learning and for peak performance. Often ignored or taken for granted, your emotional state drives the quality of your focus and thus the results you can achieve. If you work in a fear-driven organization that is low on trust, your performance will necessarily suffer. It's a neurological fact. But if you work in a group that is high on trust and low on fear, then you can achieve at your best. The better you understand yourself, your personal psychology, and your emotional hot buttons, the better able you will be to hold yourself in the right emotional state for focus, while steering clear of the negative states that render sharp focus impossible. Positive emotion, in turn, galvanizes engagement. Engagement. You must be interested in order to pay close attention. You must also be motivated. Interest and motivation equal engagement. Such engagement develops naturally when you work in your sweet spot, the overlap of three spheres: what you love to do, what you are very good at doing, and what advances the mission of the group or what someone will pay you to do. In addition, there should be some novelty in what you're doing and some room for creative input on your part to hold your attention. Lack of novelty leads to boredom, which leads to loss of focus. But beware. Too much novelty and too much creative input will cause you to wander all over and grow confused, which is why you also need structure. Structure. Such a simple word, but such a magnificent tool when used creatively and wisely. Armstrong's 10% Think Time is a perfect example of structure. Structure refers to how you shape your day, how you spend your time, what boundaries you create, what rules you follow, which assistants you employ, what filing system you use, what hours you keep, what breaks you take, what priorities you set up, which tasks you take on and which you farm out, what plans you make, and what flexibility you create. Without structure, focus is impossible. Chaos reigns. In order to create, preserve, and promote your own best structures, you need to take control. Control. In today's world, if you don't take your time, it will be taken from you. Most people exert less control over how they use their time than they should. Take back control. The fact is, most people give away great gobs of their time and attention every day without meaning to, and usually without being aware that they are. They surrender their attention to the onslaught of modern life without putting up much of a fight, as if they were overmatched. No one would dump $150 into the garbage every day, but most of us flush at least 150 minutes every day without even noticing we're doing it. These five elements, energy, emotion, engagement, structure, and control, combine to create a plan that will allow you to perform at your best without feeling frazzled, frantic, and feckless. As I will show in chapters 7 through 13, you need to individualize your own plan based on your situation and your own personality and emotional makeup. But the basic elements of this plan will work for everyone. Each of the six syndromes found in chapters 1 through 6 illustrates one person's struggle to focus. You will likely see some of yourself in a few, even a bit of yourself in all of them. To help you sort out where you should put most of your efforts, I created an assessment which can be found at hbr.org/assessments/ADT. This will give you a weighted score, showing you which of the syndromes most apply to you. With this knowledge in hand, this book will help you get started on combating the distractions you most commonly deal with and developing your plan to regain focus at work. Part 1. The six most common distractions at work and how to overcome them. Chapter 1. Screen sucking. How to control your electronics so they don't control you. People who fit the category of ADT outlined in this chapter tend to agree with the following statements. If my cell phone is out of reach, I feel distressed. I can waste an hour online without even knowing it. I have more to do than time to do it. I lack discipline. I secretly go online at work and at home. I often retreat into the cyber world when stressed at work. I can't imagine not taking my smartphone with me to lunch. I always want more. I underachieve at work. I have the will. I just haven't found the way. Les Marshall stared at the computer screen he always had set at eye level as he typed, fluently, effortlessly, almost as if on automatic pilot, like a pianist playing a piece he's played 1,000 times before. He displayed no emotion, and other than the movement of his fingers, he showed no movement other than an ever so slight rocking back and forth of his upper body. His browser was open to several windows at once. One was open to Morningstar.com, where Les could look up the latest earnings and trend information that he needed to produce his report. Another was open to a blog on Huffington Post, another to ESPN.com, and a fourth to eBay, where Les could browse and shop for the Harley motorcycle gear, Art Deco lamps, kitchen tools, and other stuff he amused himself with. Of course, there was the window open to MrSkin.com, where Les could ogle nude photos of lovely celebrity women or watch clips from the more explicit parts of recent movies. But he'd shifted from sex to food, thinking about picking up groceries for dinner after work, so he'd checked out CooksIllustrated.com as well. since he and his wife were trying to conceive a child, yet another screen was open to a fertility calendar that she had told him about. In fact, all the stray thoughts that he'd had during the day seemed to be open to their own website, as the browser history noted. Meanwhile, his email dinged and his iPhone pinged with every message. Like eager puppies, they, too, begged for his attention. When Les worked on a report, he was on automatic pilot. In copying and pasting text and numbers into the familiar format, Les worked without pause. Not only did he know his keyboard so well that he never had to look down at it, he never even needed to stop and think. Since his doctor had told him the straight-on eye-to-screen angle was orthopedically preferable to looking downward, head erect had become his permanent posture at work. His boss, Carl, would walk by sometimes and look in on him. Les worked with his door open unless he was in a private discussion, but since the back of Les's monitor faced the door, Carl couldn't see what Les was looking at. "Les, I can never tell if you're working or daydreaming," he'd say to him. "Look at my fingers, Carl," Les would reply, somewhat defensively. "You can see them under the monitor. My fingers are always moving. That should prove to you I'm always working." "No, you misunderstand me," Carl would say. "Sometimes I wish you would stop moving those fingers for a minute and just sit and think more about new companies we should be investing in. You used to do a lot more of that. Thinking is work, and you're a very smart man. We could really use your thoughts." "Okay, Carl, I'll give it a try," Les would say, while thinking to himself, "Sure, he wants me to think. Just as long as I still get done the mountain of work I don't have time to get done, even without wasting time thinking." As a research analyst in an investment firm, Les was paid primarily to ferret out the data on companies his superiors were interested in. He was handsomely rewarded for delivering the famously well-hewn data summaries he so regularly and punctually produced. However, over the past several years, and most especially in the past 6 months, Les had noted a gradual, but by now unmistakable, change within himself. He felt himself becoming what he called stupid. He felt he'd lost whatever flair for coming up with investment ideas he might once have had. No one had detected it as yet, except him. But he couldn't deny it, as much as he'd tried to. He couldn't help but notice the emptiness within himself now and again. It was as if all the data he lived in and with while writing his reports was polluting his mind, like so many toxic molecules, killing his curiosity, wit, and spunk, leaving him to wake each day into an increasingly drab and silent mental spring. But when he was busying himself with reports, there was plenty of action. That action was a camouflage. Lots of movement of fingers, eyes, and even synapses. The repetitive movement of fingers aligned with the repetitive patterns of his thoughts were all stimulating, in the sense that the electrical activity of his brain never waned, but none of it was original or deep. He was stalled in fast-revving mental neutral. He took on nothing difficult. He suffered no pain. He saw no gain. While Les could see the difference between himself now and his old self of just a few years ago, his ability to observe himself accurately was waning. Instead, his mind was being sucked into cyberspace, enchanted by the ubiquitous, beckoning siren of the web. He embraced this force that was taking him over with a kind of narcoleptic surrender. Dozens of screens linked to the Google universe nearly always took the center stage of his attention. Screens became octopod extensions of his body. They were eye level at his desk at work, cupped in his hand on the subway, sitting next to his fork at the dinner table, hooked to his pants when he was walking or jogging, and resting on his bedside table as he went to sleep. Never was he far from them. Lights on, but nobody home. Now 42 years old and married to Lynn, whom he'd met at work, Les knew he was in jeopardy, teetering between being all right and tumbling into an abyss. Soon he would fall one way or the other. He barely knew how he realized he was in danger, but a fading voice, like an old coach cheering him on from a distant sideline of his life, would interrupt him now and then and try to get his attention, saying, "Les, you're losing your chance at the life you want. You're losing your dream. Get a grip." But the voice would soon get drowned out by all the work there was to do. How could he ignore the work? If he were rich, he could pursue dreams, consider the meaning of life, and heed that inner voice. But since he was far from rich, he had to get the work done that he got paid to do. Pursuing dreams or pondering meaning was not work he got paid to do. "I have to be practical," he said to Lynn. "If we're going to live here and if we're going to have a baby, I have to be practical."
"You're not being practical, Les," Lynn replied. "You're just escaping. You're never with me. You're in love with your laptop. You're in a trance that just grows and grows."
"My work happens to depend upon electronics and the internet. You know that."
"I could be sitting here stark naked," Lynn said, "and you wouldn't notice. That's not normal."
"Of course I'd notice, honey. I love you. You're the sexiest girl I know," Les said, tentatively reaching out a hand, which Lynn did not take.
"I don't know whether to laugh or cry," she said. "As for a baby, unless Immaculate Conception makes a comeback, we're going to lose out on that, too."
"I'm sorry," Les said. "I know I've been preoccupied lately."
"The sad part," Lynn replied, "is that you've been preoccupied for years and you haven't even known it."
But he had known it. When that voice would speak up, that inner coach from the past, on his way to sleep, in the shower, at an odd off-guard moment, he'd feel a shiver, as if arrested by Officer Truth for a moment. But rather than heed the warning, he'd quickly rush into the demands of the day, the practical agenda he followed ostensibly in order to keep Lynn's and his life afloat. Without knowing what he was doing, he developed more and more of a habit than a compulsion, always to be online in front of a screen. If he were denied access to his email for even a minute or two, he would feel an itch, an irritable yearning for a hit of email, as absurd as that might sound. He knew it, but he kept on denying it enough that he didn't have to do anything about it. Instead, using the rationale of needing to keep up, he glued himself ever more to screens, so that even in the bathroom or in meetings, he'd be texting or surfing. He developed clever and subtle means of concealing his activity from others, lest he be thought rude. He also developed an uncanny skill of being able to respond to a question even when he had heard none of it. For example, in a meeting, he would simply hear his name, Les. Taking that as his cue, he would offer up any number of stock phrases that were sure to cover his mental disappearance. He might say, "I think we ought to get more input," or, "I like the tone of this discussion so far. We're really working as a team, even though some people might not see it," or, "There's no harm in looking at both sides." His favorite was, "I was just thinking about the idea we discussed last week. Can we go back to that?" He liked this one because it allowed him to admit he'd missed what was going on, but he'd missed it in the service of a good purpose. The more he interacted with screens, the less he interacted with live humans. After a while, he noticed that humans annoyed him more than they used to. They could not be controlled. They were rude. They disagreed. They were selfish, and so on. He also noticed that he enjoyed more and more the comfort and stimulation of the electronic world. While he rarely played games, that was a field he had yet to plow, electronic existence felt like an upgrade on regular life. In Screenland, he could be in control. He could be stimulated all the time. He was never bored.
Best of all, he could get paid for it. What a bonanza this electronic world offered. Les somehow thought it would save him and allow him to realize all his dreams. It was bitterly paradoxical that this bonanza, Les's method of saving himself, was actually destroying him, his marriage, and all his dreams, slowly, day by day. He was getting sucked down by an electronic field. Lynn warned him of the danger he was in. Carl did as well. Carl, in fact, meant it when he urged Les to spend more time thinking. Carl valued Les's creative powers, far more, as it turned out, than Les did. Les would have loved to believe both Lynn and Carl and achieve the greatness he felt he had in him. But such was the power of Les's insidiously mounting compulsion that he denied the validity of Lynn's and Carl's objections. Les's addiction. Les's form of ADT, a growing compulsion to be online, causing him to lose focus on everything else, is the fastest growing type of ADT in today's world. Once a joke, compulsive use of electronics has become a serious and widespread problem. It is the newest addiction, and, like all addictions, in its severest forms, can lead to tragic consequences. Having worked with many addicts of all kinds in my career, I found that the most poorly recognized fact about this group of people is how enormously gifted most of them truly are. Addicts have been doing what Les was doing, gradually self-destructing, for thousands of years. It is far more the rule than the exception to find ability, drive, and even genius or remarkable talent buried beneath the addiction, whatever that addiction might be. Society typically inflicts its harshest, most contemptuous scorn on addicts, adding shame to the heap of obstacles they face. But if they do manage to gain control of their addiction, they commonly go on to marvelously contribute to the world. Because it is a new problem, Les's particular addiction is usually missed or not even considered an addiction. His denial of what was going on, even though a part of him knew all too well what that was, is one of the chief reasons addicts never get the help they need. Denial is the most common trick addicts play on themselves to justify continuing their addiction. Since electronics are essential for most people's work, we don't associate them with the psychology of an addict. Yet addiction was precisely the trap Les was falling into. If he'd been able to reflect on his own past, he'd remember that both his parents, while not full-blown alcoholics, struggled to control their drinking and subjected Les to many embarrassing scenes he'd just as soon forget. He'd also remember that he himself smoked cigarettes in college and was able to quit only because the social pressure to do so became so intense. He'd recognize that he was genetically wired to be vulnerable to compulsive and addictive activities of all kinds, from substances and sex to spending and gambling, and yes, to electronics. The predisposition to addiction of all kinds resides in your genetic endowment. There are many forms of digital addiction or self-destructive digital habits. Here are just a few, all taken from the news or from my practice. A student is so attached to video games that he cannot get homework done or study for tests, and he is flunking out. During meetings, a woman sneaks onto websites on her smartphone so she can shop. She not only endangers her job, but runs up credit card debt that threatens both her marriage and her financial solvency. Internet sex sites so preoccupy a man that he loses his job and his marriage. A woman develops a cyber affair with a man she met in a chat room and about whom she doesn't care, and in so doing, brings her marriage to a crashing halt. A man gets fired from his job after repeated warnings not to spend so much time on his iPhone. Like everyone else, from spouses to parents to bosses to flight attendants, doctors, like me, wrestle with the issue of what to do about electronic addiction. Now that we've discovered this new fire, what are we to do with the Promethean problem we've set loose upon the world? Since this form of addiction has no precedent, we cannot look to the past to guide us in exact detail. But we can take from the past some general advice about addictions or bad habits. We can also learn to temper our alarm with the awareness that all change and every new technology has been greeted with fear and the wringing of hands. For example, when trains first became a common means of human transportation, newspaper articles deplored the likely epidemic of brain damage the swaying movements of the train would cause. When telephone service became widespread, experts predicted an epidemic of brain tumors as well as an inability to speak face to face. And we still hear shrill choruses deploring the watching of television, deeming TV an idiot box that will inexorably render us and our children mentally slow, if not demented. While taking care not to overreact like alarmists or Luddites, we also can't ignore what has become, in a few short years and spreading faster than kudzu, a massive problem, all made possible by the new technologies that have insinuated themselves into every minute of our daily lives. Of course, the problems caused by screen sucking are also balanced by much good. Our electronic devices help us everywhere, every day, in a multitude of ways. They helped runners and visitors at the Boston Marathon find places to stay the night following a bombing. They helped poor people in India connect with important information about health, water, and food. They help people who suffer under dictators to break free. Indeed, a person's inability to use them can be economically and socially crippling in today's world. Just as fire became a huge force for good and ill, so have our electronics. While the upside is obvious, the downside is perhaps less easy to perceive. What exactly is screen addiction? You might become a habitual watcher of television or listen to radio for hours on end, but those are a one-way stream. You absorb what the broadcast sends you, but you don't broadcast back. Our digital devices, on the other hand, are two-way. We join the online world in ways that we can't with radio or television. The internet allows us to live in a digital universe where we can do everything from start a business to fall in love. We can buy and sell, chat, seduce, interview, plan a garden, set up a marriage, buy a house, find a spouse, get an advanced degree, or mount a political campaign. It's easy to get hooked on certain online activities. Hundreds of websites exactly resemble a casino on screen. You put down your credit card and voila, you're in your own private Las Vegas. You can win or lose just as much, just as fast. Dopamine floods your brain just as it would in a real casino. You can do the same with sex, online shopping, and just about any addictive or compulsive activity that does not require your actual physical presence. The situation gets even dicier. A person can develop an addiction, as Les did, without falling prey to any of the well-known addictive activities like gambling, sex, or spending. A person can simply become addicted to the feeling of being online. Biologically speaking, the same dopamine circuitry that is activated in traditional addictions now is activated simply by spending too much time online. I've interviewed many people with this problem. They talk of their need to be online because it gives them a freewheeling state of mind where anything goes and nothing is shut down. They talk about craving it when they can't have it, and about feeling irritable and jittery on flights that don't offer Wi-Fi. They admit to losing relationships and jobs due to their inability to control their craving. They describe the feeling of being online as a kind of anesthesia that eases the pain of everyday life. What are we to do? Before developing solutions to this problem, we need to name it. We need a framework of understanding and a vocabulary to guide us through what we've gotten ourselves into. No group